So as I said, it's a great pleasure for me to be here at the Brimpt Institute. It is for me the first time. And I must say, if you compare it with my own physics department, it's rather overwhelming what you see here and how big it is. I saw that I was announced as a visitor, and for all the visitors, they give a label that you are cosmology or you are quantum fields or quantum gravity, but somehow, for some reason, they put to my name other. So I don't know what it means, but somehow I'm interested in other things. So the thing I would like to talk to you about today is something about Newton-Cartan gravity. And I will in the first part, I will give a kind of short review, because maybe it's not known to all of you what it exactly is. And then I will talk about some work I'm doing together with Jan Roseel from Vienna and Paul Townsend from Barcelona and Cambridge. Now, Newton-Cartan gravity is a kind of version. It's a non-relativistic gravity theory. It's a frame-independent formulation, reformulation of Newtonian gravity. And if you say that you study non-relativistic gravity, people always ask, what has happened to you? Why don't you stay relativistic? And has the speed gotten out of your career? So I have to explain why there's a kind of recent interest and to study in more detail this, in general, non-relativistic gravity, of which, in some sense, Newton-Cartan gravity is just one example. So, in fact, I will mention to you three motivations, and there are more. One motivation comes from holography. So, holography, all you have to know is a map between a gravity theory in the bulk and a quantum field theory at the boundary of that bulk. And some years ago, it was originally set up for a relativistic case, but some years ago, people realized that you could also do non-relativistic holography, but it was done in a special way, in which what you did is that you kept the general relativity in the bulk, but you considered background geometries that that allowed non-relativistic isometries, such as the Schrödinger symmetries or the Lipschitz symmetries, and that led then to non-relativistic field theories at the boundary, which could, for instance, describe some condensed matter system. And it was realized by these people here that the coupling at the boundary of these of the boundary field theories, these non-relativistic boundary field theories, they were coupled to non-relativistic gravity. In fact, it's a kind of extension of the usual Newton-Cartan gravity as originally introduced, because it has also what is called in the literature torsion, a special torsion called twistless torsion. And that has to do with the fact that in usual formulation of Newton-Cartan, there is no torsion, but that is inconsistent with the skill invariance of the conformal field theory. So it has to be something else, and it turns out to be kind of twistless torsion. So it's a kind of extension of the usual Newton-Cartan geometry they found at the boundary. And you really can see that the light cone, if you go to the boundary, really closes and becomes non-relativistic. Now, there is a much less well-studied and more, well, not clear what it means, version opposed to non-relativistic holography, where you also, in the bulk, people consider, you could consider non-relativistic strings, not only in the boundary, but also in the bulk, and that should lead to then to some non-relativistic gravity theory in the bulk, and people have considered that. And I will not say too much about in this talk, it's not clear, there are many questions you can ask, which are still difficult to answer, but one thing I want to remark is that if you consider what kind of non-relativistic gravity in the bulk that could be, then it's not obvious that that will be Newton-Cartan gravity. And that is because if you couple a string to gravity and you try to take the limit, then it's important that it's a string, and you have to take a kind of unusual limit, and that leads to a kind of alternative version of Newton-Cartan gravity. And the distinction with Newton-Cartan gravity is that not only time is absolute, but also there's some special spatial direction, which is related to the string. It's a kind of called a string-like version of Newton-Cartan gravity, which I will not discuss further in this talk, but it's really not just Newton-Cartan gravity. And people also have considered other non-relativistic gravity in the bulk, like Horavo-Lipschitz gravity. But Horavo-Lipschitz gravity is in some sense just a higher derivative version of Newton-Cartan gravity. It has the same relation as between the R, the Einstein-Hilbert term in general relativity, and the R squared. So people have shown, in fact, these people again, that Horavo-Lipschitz gravity also has an underlying Newton-Cartan geometry. Anyhow, in this context, non-relativistic gravity occurs. Then a second motivation is supersymmetry. Because, supersymmetry could be a symmetry of nature. People are looking for it with the LHC accelerator. But it also has developed as a tool. The idea being, the more symmetry you have, the more easier a theory is to study. And for instance, people have developed powerful localization techniques for supersymmetric field theories, and then they can calculate exactly partition functions. And all these techniques, they are applied for supersymmetric field theories in a curved background. And to obtain these supersymmetric theories in a curved background, you need a trick developed by Festucci and Seiberg, that you start from a supergravity theory with matter, and then you take a special limit, and then you get a theory, a globally supersymmetric field theory in a curved background. That's what you need to set up that calculation. But it's interesting to ask yourself, because almost all these calculations are done for relativistic field theories, but of course also non-relativistic field theories have partition functions. Can you do this also for the non-relativistic case? But then before you can investigate it in the first place, you have to make examples of non-relativistic supersymmetric theories in a curved background. And if you want to apply then this trick of Festucci and Seiberg, you need a non-relativistic supergravity. So non-relativistic supersymmetric extensions of non-relativistic gravity. And that's not easy. It turns out it's difficult, and a few examples have been given in three dimensions, but they lead to flat backgrounds, so that's not really huge. But recently we made some progress, and we are now able to construct non-relativistic supergravity theories leading to curved backgrounds. But the important ingredient is that these supergravity theories again turn out to have torsion. You really need to have special ones with torsion, and then it turns out you can do it. So I think that within a foreseeable time, we are able at least to give you examples of non-relativistic supersymmetric field theories in a curved background. Whether they can then be used for this localization technique remains to be seen, but at least there is some progress. But again, I will not talk about it in this talk. The third motivation is condensed matter, because also condensed matter people, they often work with effective field theories, and usually do this in a flat background, but that's like working in a special frame. If you couple it to a background, then it's like you look to the same field theory in a general frame. And then you can learn more things about more generic features. For instance, go back to gravity. If you want to learn about the Coriolis force, you better study a system which is in a rotating frame. If it never rotates, you will never find out about the Coriolis force. But these condensed matter people, they really only what they consider is the coupling of an effective field theory to a gravitational background, and they use it as response functions. So they do not add a separate, like Einstein-Hilbert term, to the effective field theory. So they do not consider really the dynamics. It's really as a response function, how the system reacts if you impose to certain forces. And that's why they're also more flexible with certain things. It's not really a gravity, it's an auxiliary gravity theory. It's not something, the gravity of the real world. But it is interesting because this, in fact, has a very long history, starting with Luttinger in 1964, who used an auxiliary field which later was identified as one of the Newton-Cotton fields. And then it was early work by Greit and Wilczek-Witten. And then Son, really, in the middle of 2000, he really did some important work. And he also showed that just the fact that you want to couple an effective field theory to a Newton-Cotton geometry, because an effective field theory is an expansion in derivatives, and you also have high derivatives, that leads to restrictions on the possible high derivatives. And that he used in his work to give you certain restrictions on certain physical quantities of certain systems, a quantum Hall effect and a Fermi liquid. So it's non-trivial to couple a Newton-Cotton gravity to an effective field theory, especially if you have high derivatives. And in fact, for gravity, we all know how to do it. You just covariantize things. But for the non-relativistic case, it is more complicated. But techniques have been now developed in which people know how to do that. Now, what I will do in this talk is I will talk about this application, but not in a kind of different perspective, because here, the Newton-Cotton background fields are really background fields. They aren't describing any particle. But what I will do is that I will use the same Newton-Cotton fields, but now, in order to describe a dynamical particle, a certain particle which occurs in a certain condensed matter system. And then I have to take also kind of different limits. I have to do it differently. So it's a kind of new application in the context of this condensed matter. And that I will talk about in the second part of this talk. So I've now given three motivations: the holography, non-relativistic holography, the supersymmetry, possibilities with localization, and the condensed matter. And so what I will do now is I will give you a short review of what is this now, this Newton-Cotton gravity, and then I will talk a bit more about applications in the context of this condensed matter. So before I start this short review, are there any questions or remarks? Because that's a natural point to say something. If not, so I will now start slowly, and just you don't need almost no pre-knowledge. I will tell you what I really mean by this Newton-Cotton gravity. But at least I'll give you now the motivation. So what is Newton-Cotton geometry? Well, and then I will talk about the dynamics, Newton-Cotton gravity, and then I will talk about these applications in condensed matter, where I really consider gravity fields that describe particles, massive spin 2 particles, in fact, and then some comments. So first, the geometry. So, well, Newton-Cartan geometry in a nutshell. We all know that in the non-relativistic case, the inertial frames, they are connected by Galilean symmetries. And what Newton did is he developed a law of gravity, but that law only works in frames that are connected to the Earth, so that they are in a constant acceleration with respect to free-falling frames, not in general frames. And in this special class of frames, with constant acceleration, he developed Newton's law, Newtonian gravity. And for that, he needed just one field, the Newtonian potential. But if you would have asked to Newton at that time, how, because for every physical law, you expect that it can be formulated in a frame-independent way, not only in a class of frames with constant acceleration. How does your law look like in a general frame? Newton could not have given the answer. And he realized that. And it is difficult to answer that question. And in hindsight, we understand it, because for that, to answer that question, you need geometry, the whole machinery of geometry. And that was only developed by Riemann in the middle of the 19th century. So although the question was easy to ask, it was very difficult at that time to answer. So what are these Galilean symmetries? Well, they are almost the same as the Poincaré symmetries of general relativity. The amount of symmetries is the same, but you split the translations in a separate time and space, and the Lorentz transformation is spatial and Galilean boost. But there's one important difference, and I have given here with the parameters Xi and Lambda. This one important difference is that under boost, space goes to time, but time does not go to space. In general relativity, they both go to each other, but in the Galilean case, not. And you can easily understand why, because you see space and time have different dimensions. So if you put here a lambda, then if you would like to write down this rule to get the dimensions right, you would need a factor of the velocity of light to get the dimensions right. But in non-relativistic gravity, there is no velocity of light. So you could not even write it down. So that term is missing, that's all. But that has very important consequences. That's why it goes much more differently if you make non-relativistic gravity as compared to general relativity. That is the heart of the difference. So I will show you how to construct Newton-Cartan gravity by what is sometimes called engaging procedure. It's a kind of procedure. It's not really like gating the Mills group. There are some manipulations, but it's almost like gating. But to do that, I don't like the metric, because the metric is not like a Gates field. So of course, general relativity you could formulate with a metric. That's easy. But instead of that, I will work with a Vierbein, an invertible Vierbein. And the difference is that I not only have curved indices, but also flat indices, ABC, 0, 1, 2, 3. Lorentz, these are called the Lorentz indices, the Meunier curved indices. And then most of the calculations I can do in terms of this Vierbein. I will try to avoid introduce the metric. And the reason is that the Vierbein is like a Gates field, it's a vector field. That's much easier. I can, at any point, I can give it also with a metric, but then, and that's the original literature, most of it is in terms of the metric, but then you get much more complicated identities and complications. And what I experience is that it's much easier to stay with the Vierbein. And then that means that instead of Christoffel symbols, I work with them with a kind of the Gates field of Lorentz transformation, the spin connection. And the relation is just by saying that the Vierbein is covariantly constant with respect to the all the symmetry. So I don't know whether that is part of your knowledge, but I will use the Vierbein and not the metric. That's what I want to say here, just to make the gating principle easier. And before I do the Galilei case, let's see how you get general relativity by quote-unquote gating the Poincaré algebra. So what you do is that I want to derive the kinematics, the transformation rules of general relativity. What I do is that I take the Poincaré transformations, which are now space-time translations P and Lorentz transformation M. So these are covariant indices. And I associate to every generator a Gates field. So to the P is something which I then identify as the Vierbein. And to the Lorentz transformation, which will be the spin connection. But at this point, it's still an independent field, because I just associate an independent Gates field. And this is the parameter of Lorentz transformations. And these are the curvatures, which it's not space-time curvatures, but they are just kind of the curls of this Gates field with some modifications determined by the structure constants. But the nice thing about these curvatures is that they transform in a nice way under the Gates symmetry. So they are the derivatives of the Gates field, which transform nicely, covariantly. That's why they are very useful to use. Note that I've not introduced a parameter of the space-time translations, because there is here some subtlety which I do not want to discuss too long. But instead of the space-time translations, I will use the general coordinate transformations. There is a way to reason that you should not consider the space-time translations. That's kind of abstract thing. I really want to use the translations in the manifold itself. And that's, so I declare all these gate fields to be covariant tensors with respect to general coordinate transformations. That is the analog of the translations. Now, and to get now a dependent spin connection field, what people usually do is they impose a constraint on this curvature. They say, it is called the zero torsion constraint. They say the curvature with respect to the vierbein is zero. And as I said, the curvature is the curl of the vierbein plus a term which is determined by the structure constant of the pancreatic. And what is now so nice about this constraint, first of all, it transforms nicely, but also that, you see, I also assume that this vierbein is invertible, which means that if I set it to zero and if A is invertible, I can solve for omega. So that's why, otherwise it would be an abstract constraint, but I really can use this constraint to solve for the omega, and then you get the standard expression for your spin connection field, which is a complicated expression in terms of the derivatives of the vierbein and the inverse vierbein. And that you do by nicely imposing this curvature. So in some sense, the theory is here reducible. I can find a combination of vierbeins which transforms like a Lorentz gauge field, and that's why I don't use an independent Lorentz gauge field. And that's nice. And then you get the usual formulation of generality. Now, and this I want now to do for, let's do now the Galilei algebra, do the same thing, and we get immediately Newton-Cotton gravity. But here, something goes wrong, and life is not as easy. Because if I would do the same thing for the Galilei algebra, then, so instead of translations, I do translate separately in time and space, the boost, Lorentz transformations from Galilean boost and spatial rotations. These are called the generators, HBGJ. Gauge field, so now instead of the vierbeins, I have now what I call time-like vierbeins and spatial vierbeins. The time-like vierbeins are somehow the clocks, they measure time, and the spatial vierbeins are the rods, they measure distance. And I have now independent spin connections separately for the Galilean boost and the spatial rotations. And I have curvatures here. They are nice curvatures, they transform nicely. They are the curls of these gauge fields. But the point is now, and that is the big difference, is that the curvature of these time translations is just a curl, and there's no extra term. Because that is exactly the structure constant. Remember, the difference between the Galilei algebra and the Poincaré algebra, there was a term missing in the boost. So there's a structure constant zero. So where there was a term here with these omegas in the general relativity case, that's absent here. But that's bad news, because that means that I can't set this curve to zero to help solve the spin connection. I miss an equation. And that's all I can do is I can do my best, and I can still use, I can set that to zero, but then I have less equations because I missed this one, and that means you can only solve for part of the spin connection. So that is not what we expect from a limit of general relativity. But on the other hand, it's not wrong. It's just this defines a theory. It's not wrong that you have a theory of gravity where not all spin connections are dependent, but it's not what we will call Newton-Cotton gravity. So sometimes this is called Galilei gravity. So it just shows that there's another interesting thing, that whereas general relativity is unique, there is no unique theory of non-relativistic gravity. This you could call one, and I will not use it, but it is, you could say this will be invariant in diffeomorphisms. I can even write down an action, etc. But its role is not clear. It has some tricky things which I will not discuss now, and I will skip it because I will not accept. I really want to have a spin connection which are dependent, but I'm not saying it's inconsistent. Now.
Also get this as a limit of the relativistic theory on your previous slide?
Sorry, I have a very bad ear. Say it again.
Sorry. Can you also get this theory as a non-relativistic limit of the theory on your previous slide?
Yeah, you can.
What happens to the, I mean, you had these omega mu a, omega mu a b are not completely coded in the data of the relativistic.
I will tell you what happens. Sorry, did you finish? I already started answering. Okay. This is something I do not fully understand. If you take, first of all, if I will define late the limit of Newton-Cotton gravity, I cannot do it in the Einstein-Hilbert term. It blows up, it turns out. But if I want to do the limit which would give you this theory, I can do it. I can take the Einstein-Hilbert action. I can define a reasonable non-relativistic limit, and I will explain the difference with what I will do late with Newton-Cotton in a minute. And you get an action. But the action is a bit funny, in the sense of it's not wrong, it has, but it does not contain all the omegas. In some sense, you can see this from the fact that suppose I would do this in three dimensions, suppose, because this is in fact what I say now is in any dimension, suppose you would do this in three dimensions, then you always end up with a Chern-Simons theory. the Einstein-Hilbert term becomes a Chern-Simons term, but this Chern-Simons term will be based upon the Galilei algebra. And the, unlike the Poincaré algebra, the Galilei algebra has not an invariant bilinear form. So if you write down a Chern-Simons term for a Galilei algebra, you get not all the gauge fields occur. So that's what happens. You can take the limit, but you don't get that all the gauge fields occur. So, and I've taken the limit in a paper I can show you afterwards in a first order formulation of Einstein-Hilbert action. And then you will see that, that indeed some of the omegas you cannot solve for, and they act in some sense also as Lagrange multipliers of certain constraints on the geometry. So you get a system, but it's a bit degenerate in the sense of not all fields occur, but it's not inconsistent. So you can take the limit. That's, and I will explain the difference with the Newton-Cotton limit when I come to that point. Yeah? Is that enough of an... For the moment. Okay, I can give you the reference. Now, nevertheless, although it doesn't help in solving the omegas, I will set this to zero by hand. And that is a restriction on the geometry. And that it turns out that the time like Vierbaum is a total derivative. And the reason that I do that is because I still have to restrict my geometry to have an offoliation. I want it to have a Newtonian space-time, where time is absolute. And now I compare here the complete universe with a bread. It's a Dutch bread. And every slice of bread is the universe at a given time. And so what this constraint does for you, that if you hop from one slice of bread to the other slice of bread, you could do it along different paths. But the time difference between two slices of bread will be this integral. But because tau is a total derivative, the integral only depends on the positions in the slice of bread. So it's path independent. So in other words, this is exactly what you mean by absolute time. Two observers will not disagree, whatever way they go from one slice of bread to the other slice of bread, what the time difference is between two slices of bread. And that's what we call absolute time. And that defines a foliation of your space-time. And that's a thing which we impose by hand to really have an absolute time. So I will impose this always. Now, what went wrong? Well, if you think about this Galilei algebra, there is already something funny, which is not quite what we expect, because, as I said, some of the structure constants are zero with respect to the Poincaré algebra. And one of them, it turns out that in the Galilei algebra, the commutator between a Galilean boost and a spatial translation is zero, whereas in Poincaré it's non-zero. But that's a bit funny, because that means that if you have a mass of particle, my argument only applies to mass of particles, with spatial momentum p, I should be able to bring it to a rest frame. That sounds reasonable, by a boost. But if the boost commutes with the spatial momentum, I cannot do that. So if I work with just the Galilei algebra, I cannot bring a mass of particle to a rest frame. So I really would like to have this to be non-zero. That is the source of the problem. And what people do then, and there are many other arguments that explain why you should do that, is that they add an extra generator to the right-hand side of the commutator. And that generator is called a central extension generator because it commutes with all the other generators. And it is the dimension of a mass parameter. It has something to do with mass. So that's what I do. And then the algebra is called a Barham algebra. So not anymore Galilei. So that's the difference. And for that thing, if I want to do the gauging, I start again. Then I add here also an extra gauge field, which I call mu. So that's the surprise. And I must say, each time I say it, it's a surprise for me too, that the Newton-Cotton gravity has not only a time like in a spatial Vierbaum, but an extra vector field which is related to this central extension. And then everything works. Because you see, then you can, the reason it works is that if you consider the curvature of this central charge, then that curvature also contains a spin connection. So if I set that curvature also to zero, I gain an extra equation. And then I can solve for all my spin connections. But the price you have to pay is that these spin connections are not only functions of the time like a spatial Vierbaum, but also of this vector field. And then you can write, nicely write down so the independent fields are the tau, the e, and the m, and the omegas can be solved in terms of these independent fields. And all the gauge fields transform according to the structure constants of this Barham algebra. So you see that again, so lambda is spatial rotation is always manifest, but the boost, you see that the spatial Vierbaum goes to tau, but the tau does not go to the spatial Vierbaum, but instead the m takes over. That goes to the and a Galilean boost to the spatial Vierbaum. So you can also understand without the m, you could never make a spin connection because you see these two terms are not enough to make gauge fields that transform nicely under the boost and the spatial rotations. And the reason is that it works for general relativity, but then I have an extra term. And if that term is missing, I just have not enough information to do it. And this M comes to help. It gives you a boost, and then if you add a little of M, of the curl of M to the spin connections, then you can get the boost also right, and then everything works. So that's how it works. And that's the kinematics. Now, what about the dynamics? So the equations of motion. So for that, I will do the following. So I will show you how to derive, because then I will not do engaging, but a limiting procedure. Nice thing about the limiting procedures, I can also apply it to the Einstein equation. And then I get immediately the dynamic. Whereas in the gauging, I don't know what exactly the equations of motion of Newton-Cartan gravity are. It will be certain constraints, but where do they come from? Now I can derive them. Now, the point is, now I will do a slightly, define you a limit which is not standard in the literature, but it is, for the easy cases, it is equivalent to the literature. But for more complicated cases, I claim that this is the better limit than you see in the literature. So the reason, the philosophy is as follows. We all know that if you take the Poincaré algebra and you apply the Enoni-Wigner contraction, you get the Galilei algebra. But we just saw that in order to get Newton-Cartan gravity, I want to gauge the Bargon algebra, which has one generator more. Now, for every sensible Enoni-Wigner contraction, will not give you one generator more. The number of generators remain the same. So the only way, if ever I want to get the Bargon algebra, is if I extend the Bargon algebra with an extra generator, which commutes with all the other generators of the Poincaré algebra. And then I will show you by a nice trick that if you now do a kind of modified Enoni-Wigner contraction, that this generator ends up as the central extension of the Galilei algebra. And that's how you get it. But the fact that I needed to add this U1 means that if I gauge it, it's reasonable that if I gauge Poincaré, I get relativity, but if I gauge the U1, I want to add an extra vector field. And that vector field will be needed in order to define a limit of relativity. And since I do not want to have extra degrees of freedom, I take the curl of M to zero. So I do not want to have relativity plus an extra degree of freedom. It's really an auxiliary field, just for the sake of defining the limit. One way that you can see that this M is really needed is that a very easy calculation, just take a particle and couple it to generativity. And take the limit, and you'll see that the limit blows up. It's always a term which blows up. It is not often stressed in the literature, but it's true. And this M helps you now because you can couple the particle to a Vesemino term. The vector field you can couple to a particle via a Vesemino term. And then that Vesemino term gives an extra infinity, and that cancels the other infinity. And then you can, so the M really is essential to define limits where things do not blow up. So that's why in some sense the M is needed. And then if I take the limit, I will show you get nicely Newton-Cartan gravity. And then I can do it also in the equations of motions, and I get nicely the equations of motions of Newton-Cartan gravity. So how is this contraction trick? Well, the standard contraction of Poincaré is that you start from the Poincaré algebra, generators PA, space-time translators, and Lorentz generators. And what you do is you express the relativistic generators, you do a time-space split, into the non-relativistic generators of the Galilei algebra, but with an extra contraction parameter, you rescale. And then you substitute that in the Poincaré algebra, that's just a redefinition, but then you take the limit, once you have substituted, you take the limit omega to infinity, and then you get the Galilei algebra. But in that process, you will see that this becomes zero, because we can do it the calculation, because this comes from an M with a P gives a P0. Now the M gives an omega G, here I have an omega, and the P0 gives a 1 over omega H. So in total, at the right-hand side, I get 1 over omega squared h, and if omega goes to infinity, you get 0 at the right-hand side. So that's the Galilei algebra, but I want to get the Bargon algebra. So how do I get now the central extension here at the right-hand side? Well, the trick is simple. You start now from Poincaré times a U1. So I have here a U1 generator, which has nothing to do with Poincaré. It's completely commuting. But the trick is that if I express my relativistic generators in terms of the non-relativistic one of the Bargon algebra, I do not just a rescaling, but I take the sum and the difference of two generators. That's essential. It has to do with null direction. So this is the extra term. So the Z is the generator of the Bargon algebra, which will become the central extension. The curly Z is the original U1 of the relativistic generator. And the fact that this is now a sum, that changes this calculation. Because remember, this PAG was an omega at the left-hand side, but then the P0 became, that was this term, that's 1 over omega. And then I got 1 over omega squared, and I got 0. But now I have this extra term with omega Z. And if I divide by omega, it becomes Z. So now suddenly I get a term that survives, and that is the central extension. So that's how this U1 really helps you in getting the Bargon algebra. So, and now what I do is that inspired by this Enoni-Wigner contraction, which is mathematically well defined, I do the same limit at the level of the field. But if I do it at the level of fields, things are a bit more tricky. I think mathematicians will be less pleased with that. So what I do is that I take the fields of general relativity, I have this extra field corresponding to the U1, and I express them in the fields that will become, after taking the limit, the fields of Newton-Cartan gravity. And note that I have, since it's vector field here, I have a natural M here, but I don't rescale the gravitational fields. I take some undifferences, exactly like in this inner-liquid contraction. Now, there are several things which complicate things. That's why this is a bit more tricky. One thing is that the V-bind is invertible. So that means that if I expand this, then for the inverse V-bind, I get an infinite expansion. But only the leading terms will survive. And another tricky thing is that in the algebra case, the Lorentz generator is independent, but the spin connection, I take the limit in the second order formulation where the spin connection is dependent. So I cannot take a separate rescaling of the spin connection. I really have to calculate how the spin connection transforms under these redefinitions by using its explicit expression. And the danger of all these things is that things can blow up, and they do blow up. But now comes to help the fact that we have said that the curl of M is to zero. That gives you this constraint, and that this constraint helps you to lower the degree of freedom of omega. So you have certain divergent terms, but if you use this in the calculation of the spin connections, then you push, there's a leading term which diverges, but you push it to the subleading term, and that then does not diverge. And then you can take the limit and everything works. Note also that if I take in this expression itself the limit omega to infinity, I get zero, the zero torsion condition. So this limit always leads to Newton-Cartan gravity with zero torsion. But it's a bit technical, but believe me, there is a procedure, and if you do it, then you get the following results. That if you take this whole thing and you substitute in the transformations of general relativity, you take the limit to omega to infinity, you get precisely the transformations of all the Newton-Cartan fields are just derived. That's the kinematic. But the nice thing is also that if I do the same thing in the Einstein equations of motions, I immediately get the correct equations of motions for Newton-Cartan gravity. So I also have now the dynamics, and I will show you in a minute what they are. And if ever I had to write a book on general relativity, which I probably will not do, then I really think that the standard general relativity books, they only discuss the Newtonian limit, immediately getting Newton gravity. But that's really pedagogically not nice, because there you do two things at the same time. Namely, first of all, you take the non-relativistic limit, and secondly, you go from a general frame to special frames, because Newtonian gravity was only valid in special frames. It's what I do now is I really take the limit while staying in a general frame. And that's much nicer. And then I always can restrict myself to special frames and get back Newtonian gravity. But these are two different things, which has nothing to do with each other. You have the non-relativistic limit and the general frames. And that's also what Einstein did when he discussed general relativity. He really did two things which are independent of each other. He realized that to get relativistic gravity, he had to extend Galilei to Poincaré. And he realized to get frame-independent formulations, he had to use geometry. But the last question, you can ask for any law, even for Newton, and the answer is Newtonian gravity needs its own geometry, which is now a foliated geometry. That's the only difference. It's not the standard Riemannian geometry, but it's a foliated geometry. Now, and these are the equations of motions. You get as many as the Einstein equations, and they are constraints on the curvatures of the boost, Galilean boost and spatial rotations. And if you decompose them in representation of spatial rotations, this is a singlet. This just means that you take a time spatial projection of a curvature component. That's zero. And this has two free indices. One is a spatial index, the other is a time and space index. If you take the mu time, you get a vector. And if you take the mu space, you get a symmetric spatial tensor. So they are exactly the number of the Einstein equations. So there are just certain constraints on the curvatures of the boost. And these two curvatures, by the way, they form exactly the Riemann curvature of space-time. If you decompose the Riemann curvature tensor of space-time, you get it's a combination of these two curvatures. Now, there are a few notable things. One is that you cannot write down an action that gives rise to these equations of motion. So there's no action for Newton-Cartan gravity. And as I said, if you try to take this limit, which I just explained, in the Einstein-Hilbert action, unfortunately, it blows up. Now, if I say this, there are always people say, well, you can do this or that, and then maybe there is an action, and maybe there is an action, and you have to find a trick. But all I'm saying is that I've never seen in the literature an action giving rise to these equations of motion. And also note that this is a complicated expression, because you have to write down the definitions of these curvatures. But this is exactly now the frame-independent formulation of Newton's law of gravity, which without sources, just the Laplacian the Poisson equation of the Newton potential is zero. So how is it hidden in this, the net effect is hidden in this singlet equation, and how is it hidden? Well, this is complicated because it works in any frame. That's why I need all these gravitational fields. But if I only want this law to be valid in frames with constant acceleration, then I can gauge fix, I can restrict my gravitational fields. I don't need so many gravitational fields. So if you set the tau just to one, the e to one, and the spatial part of mi to one, and the zero component to phi, then the whole thing collapses, almost everything becomes zero, and this thing gives you exactly Laplacian phi is zero. So in that sense, this complicated law is an extension of this law. And note that it's not so strange that the Newton potential is exactly the time component of the gauge, of the central charge gauge field. Because remember, when I said if you take the limit of a particle coupled to Newton-Cotin, you have to add a Wesson-Minow term. So in the limit, that if you take the Wesson-Minow term, becomes just a phi in these special frames. And we all know that if you consider a particle moving under the influence of a Newton potential, you just add a phi term to the particle. And that's exactly this what is left over of this Wesson-Minow term. So in that sense, everything seems to work. So now I want to say, how much time do I have left?
Like 20 minutes? 20 minutes.
Yeah. Now I want to say something about where we use all these things in a different way, where we also are concerned about propagating particles, about matter. But before I do that, is there any question about, is the end of my short review of Newton-Cotin gravity? Is there any question or is everything understood? Yeah.
Is it somehow the procedure that you're describing related to...
So say it again.
The procedure that you're describing related to null reduction? I mean, it looks very, very
similar. Well,
it's like if you take an extra gauge field and call it an extra coordinate or something.
Well,
like that.
Yes and no. I mean, it's well known that the Bargmann algebra can be embedded in a Pancré algebra of one dimension higher by a null embedding. It's also true that if you take, let's say, five-dimensional generativity, and you take a null reduction, you do get Newton-Cotin gravity. Yeah, it's a one way, but it's not this. It's true that the null reduction of five-dimensional generativity gives you Newton-Cotin gravity. In fact, also without an action, because it's not like a Kluze-Klein reduction. You can't do a Kluze-Klein reduction. You can do in the action. Here you can't, and the reason is that the null reduction requires the existence of a null killing vector, and that gives you a constraint on the geometry. That's the absence of the dilaton. But if it's not the most general ansatz, and that's why you can only do it in the equations of motion. And then you do get the equations of motion due to Newton-Cotin gravity. But that's really, you see, the null reduction is a trick to get a non-relativistic answer. But it's not like it doesn't represent some physics. It's a trick. Although I agree with you that this limit has features of a null reduction, but this limit is really a limit in four dimensions. It's not the same as a null reduction, because here you really take a limit. I've thought about it, but I don't see the connection. But I agree with you that the plus and minus resembles, of course, null directions. Yeah, that's for sure, yeah. Now, what about non-relativistic matter? And my motivation is that, because we know that generativity describes a massless spin 2 particle. And it just happens in the context of these condensed matter applications that, we all know about the fractional quantum Hall effect, but maybe what is not so well known, at least I didn't know, that already in the 80s it was found that if you look to a certain gap states, that they form excitations of a massless spin 2 particle. That was found by this Gerwin, McDonald, and Platzmann in 1985, and it's called the GMP mode. Well, so far so good. And I'm myself not a condensed matter physicist, but my attention was called by a paper by Grom and Vasson of a year ago, where they proposed to add to the usual effective field theory of the fractional quantum Hall effect, an effective field theory describing that massless spin 2 particle, this GMP mode. And it is really the fact that it has something to do with metrics and geometry was already inspired by an earlier paper by Haldane. But of course, this is a non-relativistic system, and they just made an ansatz. So they wrote down an effective field theory, but it was first of all non-relativistically, but also spatially covariant. They don't include the boosts. They just try to guess something using only space metrics. And furthermore, they use two metrics. It's called bimetric, but that is because, you see, these days, these fractional quantum Hall states are made also on non-trivial geometries, and they want to describe the spin. They need one metric to describe the spin 2 particle, and the other one to describe it in a curved background. So that's why they need two metrics. And they remind themselves when they wrote it down that it remarkably looks similar to recent models of massive gravity. And because also in the gravity community, we try to assign a mass to the graviton, because then maybe it changes the workings of gravity at large distances, and maybe it can be helpful. And so they described this effective field theory, and they showed that in a linearized approximation around a flat background, it gives you exactly a Schrödinger equation for a massless spin two particle. I call it planar because it's in three dimensions, or two spatial directions. That it gives in that limit this Schrödinger equation. So, and when we saw that paper, we thought by ourselves, could it be that effective field theory and this Schrödinger equation they propose, that it can be considered as the limit of some massive gravity theories? It need not be the case. It's not true that, of course, that every non-relativistic answer is the limit of a relativistic answer. But on the other hand, what they had looked very much like one of these biometric massive gravity theories. And if you could take the limit and the thing is more or less unique, then maybe it is the limit. So that was the question, and that I would like to discuss now. And now, first of all, you should realize that when we take the limit so far, we took really what I call a force limit in which a particle disappears. Because remember, general relativity has a massless spin two particle, but Newton-Cartan gravity has no particle. The equation was the Laplacian phi zero. There are no time derivatives. Because gravity, see, in general relativity, the gravitational force is carried by a massless particle, the graviton, but in Newton-Cartan gravity works instantaneously. So there is no carrier of the non-relativistic force. There is no particle. That's what I call the force limit. If you just take a Klein-Gordon equation, that puts you all the factors with M and C, and you take the naive non-relativistic limit, that's what we did so far, and you have to keep this thing, which is the wavelength, you keep it fixed, then what you just get is a massive deformation of your Poisson equation. And that is what we call then a massive deformation, but it's not a deformation, sorry, but it's not a massive spin zero particle. So here you have a massive, relativistic massive particle, but here this is a force limit, it is no particle anymore. So this is not what I want. I want a Schrödinger equation, because that's what this Schrödinger-Poisson had. And to do that, it turns out that, and it's well known in the literature, is that you have to take a complex Klein-Gordon field. Because if it's complex, you see the problem here is always that this goes to zero and this would blow up, but you keep this combination fixed. But if this goes to zero, of course, the time disappears. So you have to do something different. And the trick is now that since it's complex, you can make a redefinition with a phase factor. And you already see mc squared smells like something like a zero energy. This has to do with the fact that the Dirac, et cetera, that you have to get rid of certain infinities of zero point energies. But anyhow, here you just do this redefinition. And if you do that redefinition, it turns out it's a clever redefinition, because then after the redefinition, the whole thing looks like this. And you have canceled this term which would blow up. It's canceled by this redefinition. And this term still goes to zero, but in the meantime, due to the redefinition, there's also a term linear in the time derivative. This is a standard thing you will find in any textbook. And if you then, after making this redefinition, take the limit C to infinity, you get a nice Schrödinger equation. And this is a nice massive propagating particle. Realize also that the Schrödinger equation can only be defined for a complex field. So it's not that strange that I can only do it for a complex field. It's not something like a real Schrödinger equation. Now, and if you do this now for this was for a massive spin zero particle, but you also can do it for massive spin one, that's Broca, or massive spin two, that is Fields-Pauli, then it works. I'm not going to give the details, but it works in the same way, only there are now more modes, because and spin one in three dimensions has two modes, plus one and minus one ellipses. And spin two in three dimensions has also two modes, plus two and minus two ellipses. And what happens is that for every mode, you make the theory complex. I take complex Broca, like complex Klein-Gordon, complex Fritz-Pauli. And if you do all these redefinitions, you get for every complex ellipsity mode, you get one Schrödinger equation. So I get for the Broca case, I get two Schrödinger equations, one for the plus one helicity mode and one for the minus one helicity mode. And the same for Fitzpauli. Now, but that's not so nice because, well, this only works if you complexify your theory, whereas this Gromov-Poisson had a real field theory. So you could ask yourself the question, would it be possible also to take a particle starting from a real field theory without this complexification? And that is a little trick. That's what we invented in a recent paper, that indeed, at least at the free level, I will discuss interactions in a minute, you can take a limit, getting particle, without the need to complexification. And the trick is very simple. That is namely, you start, I explained to you for Proca, in a minute I will show you how it goes similarly for spin two. But you take a Proca theory, you make a decomposition in time and space, then it turns out that this E0 is an auxiliary field, which you can eliminate. You have to do some complicated redefinition. I will not give you the details, but the point is now, and that's the important point, is that in three dimensions, the spatial components of a vector are just two. So the spatial rotation group in three dimensions is SO2. And that's nicely something that is a U1. So what you can do is that these two components, that's why it only works in three spacetime dimensions, you can combine into a complex scalar. And if you work it out, you go instead of a vector, you work with this complex scalar, then you get exactly the same Lagrangian as for Klein-Gordon, the complex Klein-Gordon. And then if you take C to infinity, you would do the redefinition, the same trick, and you do the C to infinity, you get a single spin one Schrödinger equation. This thing, by the way, breaks parity, because this GMP mode also breaks parity, and that's a bit strange because Proca itself is parity even, but the subtlety is that if you do parity, that is B2 goes to minus B2, that is going B to B star, but then since this is a phase factor, then this blows up. If you can't make this redefinition, it breaks parity because the phase factor itself has to disappear. And if you take a parity, then you get a flip of sign here, and then the phase factor doesn't cancel, etc., and things blow up. So this whole thing breaks parity, and you get this is a nice single Schrödinger equation. And if you do this for spin two, the same thing happens. It's the only difference is that for a vector, the three-component vector was a singlet and a doublet under SO2. And this was the describing the Schrödinger equation. And for spin two, you have 5 degrees of freedom. There's one singlet and now 2 doublets. But these act like the singlet and doublet act like auxiliary fields. You can eliminate them. And then this component, this complex component, that describes a single planar spin two Schrödinger equation. And this combination is exactly the one which also occurs in this paper of Gromov and Fasson. So it at the linearized level, at least, you can see that indeed this proposal of Gromov and Fasson follows at the linearized level from a Masters Fields Pauli theory. Now, I have 10 minutes to introduce interactions. Because that's where it's called. Because really, what we would like to do, of course, is have not just a free Proca or free Fields Pauli, but really a massive gravity theory, a nonlinear massive gravity theory, and then take the limit and get this nonlinear effective field theory of Gromov and Fasson. And at the linear level, everything works, everything becomes Fields Pauli. Now, that is not so easy, and that's really our work in progress. So we are busy with doing it. But one thing is for sure, that if you want to do it, you have to invent a few more tricks. So the point is that three dimensions is very special with tricks. Namely, first of all, in three dimensions, you have the possibility that you can also have parity odd theories in which you describe only one helicity mode at a time. And that has to do with the fact that the Klein-Gordon operator is decomposable in three dimensions. You can write this thing here, describes two helicity states in three dimensions, plus or minus. But each of these operators describe one helicity state. So the Klein-Gordon operator, when acting on a vector or a tensor, can be decomposed into these projection operators, which project on the separate states. And you can write down equations for just separate helicity. That's things like topologically massive electromagnetism, topologically massive gravity, etc. That's why you can do that. And you have to make use of it. And the second thing is that you also can write down equivalent theories describing the same spin in three dimensions, but with less or more derivatives. And that has to do with the fact that often, for instance, if you go to Proca, then often one of the equations of motions is an auxiliary restriction on the vector field, namely the divergence is zero. And the special thing about three dimensions is that you can solve this constraint completely. The most general solution is given in terms of another vector field with one derivative more. And that means that you can substitute this back in the equations of motions and then integrate it back to an action. And then you can really what we call boosting up the derivatives. So for instance, we construct a few years ago a theory of what we called new massive gravity, which was an R plus R squared term describing a massive spin two particle. But that was just the result of this boosting up the derivatives of just Fields Pauli. So if you take the Fields Pauli theory, it's a normal theory. And then we use this trick in the case of spin two to boost up the derivatives. And in this case, you get 2 derivatives. And then we could suddenly write down this whole theory of new massive gravity. The nice thing of this solving is also that often people write mass terms with break the Gates invariant, whereas this constraint that reintroduced the Gates invariant, because this B is always a Gates invariant. That's why that is a nice trick. And the third thing, which is special, is that many of the massive gravity theories, which are known in three dimensions, like new mass of gravity or like topological mass of gravity, or there are many more, bimetric gravity, they all turn out to be of the form of what we call a transimus-like formulation. They can be written in this general form, where the A's represent, they have three indices. They are covariant vectors. They have a Lorentz vector, also a Lorentz vector index, and R is a flavor index. You have a number of them. So for instance, new mass of gravity, R plus R squared, can be written in terms of a number of these A's, where some of the A's occur as auxiliary fields. And if you solve them, you get the higher derivatives. And this is a very nice representation of these all these gravity theories. And that could be very useful if you want to induce interactions. And if you use all these things, then still you could wonder, should I consider a real Lagrangian and take a real limit using this trick I just introduced? Or you still could say, I complexify the Lagrangian. I take the usual standard complex limit. But once I've taken the limit, I can always take a consistent truncation, because throwing away one of the Liszt modes is often a self-duality constraint. So these are the things you will need in order to do it. But whether it works, I cannot yet promise. But this is one strategy. There is yet one more strategy, and that's what I want to close by in the last 5 minutes, is that you say, well, why should I take a limit? Why don't I try immediately to make this effective field theory starting from a construction in three dimensions and not taking any limits? Because as we saw from gravity, many of these things can be written as transimus theories, and they are based on relativistic algebras. So could we also write down immediately transimus-like mass of gravity theories based on non-relativistic algebras, like Galilei and Bargmann? Well, that is not so easy, because the funny thing is that although it's well known that general relativity in three dimensions can be written as a transimus theory, but that's related to a property of the Poincaré algebra, because that has an invariant bilinear form. And although the Galilei algebra is a limit in the Wigner contraction of the Poincaré algebra, the Galilei algebra itself does not allow an invariant bilinear form, neither does the Bargmann algebra. So if you write down a transimus action, you miss certain terms. You get a kind of degenerate theory. It's not good. But the funny thing is that exactly in three dimensions, and only in three dimensions, you can add one more central extension to the Bargmann algebra, or two to the Galilei. That's called the extended Bargmann algebra. And that has two central extensions. The first one is the one we already discussed in this talk. It's related to a mass parameter. And the second one is related to spin. Now, remember also in this whole quantum Hall effect is based on collective modes where you have things behave like fractional statistics, anions, etc. And somehow the second central extension has to do with this special feature of spin in three dimensions. And the nice thing is that once you add this extra central extension, the algebra does allow an invariant bilinear form. So there is an interesting non-relativistic algebra in three dimensions, which is suitable to write down transimus-like gravity theories. And now, to make a bimetric theory, you only have to use two algebras. And then the trick is somehow to write a transimus algebra, an extended transimus action for these two algebras, which maybe in one stroke of a genius could give you this effective field theory of Gromov for some. But you have to do it in a special way, because I don't want to end up with a mass of gravity theory, which is a mass of deformation of the Poisson equation. I really want to end up with a theory describing a dynamical propagating particle, a Schrödinger equation. So you have to understand exactly how to do that. And we are busy to doing that. But at the moment, I really can only not say that maybe it works and maybe it doesn't work. On the other hand, there is something already proposed in the literature. So you should be able, because their theory is really not invariant in the boost, etc. So it really has a drawback. And it should be possible to derive it by a nice, there's some geometry behind it, so it should be possible. But unfortunately, I cannot yet give you the final answer. So to end this talk, I gave you a review on what Newton-Cartan gravity and Newton-Cartan geometry is. And we saw that central extensions play an important role in the construction. And that also explains why non-relativistic gravity is not unique, because there are two ways you can do. First of all, you can count the number of central extensions. Zero central extensions, that's what we call Galilei gravity. One central extension is Newton-Cartan gravity. But this extended Bargmann algebra has two central extensions. If you write it down in transimus theory, it's a different gravity theory than Newton-Cartan gravity. And the other thing which you can is also makes it not unique is that foliation you impose. Because if you impose a foliation in which you say time is special, then you get the gravity that typically couples to a particle. But you could also impose other foliations. You could also say, I take a foliation where the leaves are two-dimensional, one time, one space. Then you get what we could call a string-like extension of Newton-Cartan gravity, and that's the gravity, non-relativistic gravity, that naturally couples to a string. So every every extended object couples to its own non-relativistic gravity in a natural way. And then, well, I told you about our efforts to reproduce this this proposal by Gromov and Som to get this effective field theory. And we have not yet there, but you are busy with it. And I will give in a few weeks a talk also in Chicago where they are. So hopefully we'll make some progress. But if it would work, suppose, in a dream, it's really nice because if you study this literature, it's really interesting. And I'm fair to say I'm a gravity man and maybe a three-dimensional gravity man. But there's a lot of literature in three-dimensional gravity about, first of all, high derivatives, like this new mass of gravity. It's in every theory of quantum gravity is high derivatives, very natural. And also there's a lot of study about adding high spins. So now I talked about a mass of spin 2 particle. We can also talk about mass of spin 3, spin 4. And these high spins are thought to be also be relevant for quantum gravity. They follow from string theory, et cetera. So we did a lot of work on that. But the funny thing is that if you go to this condensed matter literature, there is also a huge literature about these guys because, well, high derivatives is natural because an effective field theory, after all, is an expansion in derivatives. So they naturally have high derivatives. But also, funny enough, beyond this GMP mode, there are also high spin. So in this fraction quantum Hall effect, there are also high spin excitations. They are called something like magnetorotons. They are discussed in this paper here. So they do say also there's a spin 3, spin 4. And both in the gravity and condensed matter literature, they even discussed the case of an infinite number of spins. And then you have to work with this infinite spin algebras like area preserving diffeomorphisms. But clearly, I can smell that the two communities talk about similar things, which are strongly related. So if you could relate these two things by a limit, then you really could, well, you could discuss and learn something. And there is something worthwhile to investigate here. It's really interesting that you do think about similar things in a completely different context. So that's what I very much like. So I want to add this talk by saying that the nice thing about this new Dubuque-Catan gravity and geometry is that it has connections with many things. After all, our life is basically non-relativistic. So there are many people from the condensed matter, the mathematics, gravity, and string theory. And I was last year in a conference in Paris, and to my surprise, there are even engineers who work on new Dubuque-Catan geometry. They want to calculate the strength of steel, et cetera, certain properties. And if you do it the fancy way, they really need this full, amazingly close, this new Dubuque-Catan geometry, et cetera, to do it. So even at the level of the engineers, they are interested in it. So I hope that's it, and I hope you enjoyed the talk.
The idea for the effective theory of this GMP mode.
What?
The effective theory for this spin 2 mode.
Yeah.
GMP mode. So the point is that you expect that the effective theory, I mean, using this covariant construction, you will somehow constrain the effective theory. You will get some specific effective theory. And why does the condensed matter realization, why should satisfy these constraints? I mean,
well, first of all, I don't know whether what they propose is the result of a limit of a certain constriction, because that, of course, isn't an. I mean, well, in the limit case, I assume that their proposal is the limit of a relativistic answer, which I don't know. But on the other hand, I would think that since you have to satisfy all these symmetries, the theory should be reasonably constrained, at least at the low derivative level, because to satisfy all these constraints, and I get as a bonus, I get these boost symmetries automatically. Now, in the second part, when I did this John Simons thing. Of course, I directly construct it, and I don't know how unique it is, but again, I would expect it to be reasonably unique. So I would not expect that there's much flexibility, at least to get there. It's like the Einstein-Hilbert term. I would expect the R part, that is unique. And of course, if you add even high derivatives, I don't know how unique it will be. Then I'm not sure about how unique it is, but at least at lowest order, that's their proposal. So far, I would expect an answer which is, by symmetries, is reasonably constrained and unique. But I'm not 100% sure of that. I cannot prove it, of course.
So the first step is to reproduce what they already have.
Yeah. But first, you have to understand that. Otherwise, and that's really the interactions. That is the difficult thing. So that's really, once you have that, then there's a whole world open for follow-up things. That is, first, we have to understand that.
Put some constraints on these materials, but do you know if there is a way to mimic the gravitational effect in the lab by, I don't know, putting well, stress on the material. I mean, I don't
yeah, but that's exactly what it is. You stress the system. It's really an auxiliary field which you push and stress. For viscosity calculations, it's often used. You push and stress the material a bit by these gravitational fields and see how it reacts. That's, I think, the way I understand how they use it. They couple this effective field to gravity, so then they can see how it on geometric forces, how it reacts, and then that response they can calculate. In fact, it's interesting, I forgot to say that, but just something simple as the energy momentum tensor, which is for us simple. If you have general theory, there's energy momentum tensor, and we know what it is, and that's it. For them, this is very difficult, because they don't like, in some sense, they don't like the standard Newton-Cartan gravity, and the reason is that, you see, we impose a constraint by hand, this foliation. But it's very dangerous, because if you impose a constraint on the gravitational field, then you don't get the most general response. So what they do is they... So what they do is they forget about... They're not interested in causality or so, or the absolute time. It's just an auxiliary field. So they often forget about this torsion zero constraint, just use complete torsional Newton-Cartan gravity, and then they can calculate the energy momentum, they can calculate the energy and momentum flow, et cetera, and work with these things. So in that sense, they are much more flexible. They do not really use gravity in the way as a force, but really as an auxiliary field to calculate properties of their effective field theory.
Then this means that what they actually think in the condensed matter literature, is it true that what they think is that the constraint that they will find in the lab are the most general, also including, say, those that come from non-foliation?
It's a diffeomorphism which gives the strongest constraint in some sense. Because what they do require, what they have to require, is that also their theory is frame independent. That they cannot give up. They have to say it's invariant under diffeomorphisms. And so there is a very confusing literature in which sometimes people talk about non-relativistic coordinate transformations. But that's because they don't introduce this vector field. You really have to introduce this vector field, and then you really have separate. The diffeomorphisms are exactly like in general relativity. There's no difference. It's just frame independence. And that they have to satisfy, and that gives the strongest set of constraints on their model. But for instance, I told you that, for instance, in three dimensions, there is this new version of gravity based on this extended Bargon algebra. And nobody tells you, to condensed matter, which model of gravity should you use. Well, all they want is in frame independence, whether they have one or two. I mean, the suggestion is even that they like this new gravity theory because it has an extra central charge related to spin, and they always have an extra emerging U1 of anions. So it could well be that they prefer to use that one, but even there, the rule is not clear. Which gravity theory should you use to couple two? Because they care about diffeomorphism invariance, but if they have their two ones, which one should you use? It's not clear.
In which commutation relation does it appear, the extra new central charge?
It's just a singlet. It's just a singlet, like the mass is also a singlet.
But this one appeared in Galilean and...
It occurs in the comet, so the mass occurs in the commutator of the space translation and the boost. This other one is a different dimension. It occurs in the commutator of two boosts. Two boosts gives you this this other second central extension.
Any other question? If not, let's think of Spear again.